The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I am Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today I am joined by an historian specialising in the history of Oliver Cromwell, his family and the politics of the interregnum period following the Civil Wars. She is a trustee of the Cromwell Association and has written two historical novels about the Cromwell family, The Puritan Princess and The Rebel Daughter. She also contributes features and book reviews to publications including History Today, The Critic and BBC History. And together with Paul Lay, she hosts the podcast 1666 and All That, all about 17th century history. I am delighted to say that today's guest is Miranda Malins. Hello.
Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute joy. I'm going to get an education today, so I'm really looking forward to this. But before I get my education, I need to ask you, this is Inspired Minds. What does inspiration mean to you? Is it something that's important in your work, professional, daily life? What is inspiration for Miranda?
Well, I'd say it is something that's important. I think particularly so when you are engaged in any kind of creative endeavor, for instance, writing books. Because the thing about writing books is, you know, they didn't exist before you write them. Sounds a very obvious thing to say, very stupid thing to say. You have created something completely out of nothing. And you need to have a bit of inspiration, recklessness, faith in yourself in order to do that. Something which stimulates you to be creative. And I think really inspiration, it might begin as something that makes you think about something you want to do. But it's when it then transforms from wanting to do something into feeling that you can do it that I think you really get things done. And then that breeds its own ambition, and then that breeds its own additional inspiration. So if you're lucky and you find something to do that you love, you can hopefully lock yourself into a virtuous cycle.
So as a writer of both history and fiction, we'll come to the history later on, but as a writer of fiction, what are the sort of like spark moments that make you go, ah, that's the book I'm going to write? Because I've never written a piece of fiction. I've thought about many ideas. I've sort of planned them in my head, but they've never come to fruition. Lots of people do this. What is the spark that gets you finally to write that book?
Well, it's always people. It's always people and stories about them. And in my fiction as well, it's all come from a love of history, really. You can't actually separate the two. I don't know if I would ever write a piece of fiction that is a contemporary piece, for instance, because it really is the past, the interplay between the past, people and places, really, that gets me going. And it's just stories, motivations, that big unknown that you have in the past, that blend between the alienness of the past and the people who lived in it, and also their very familiarity and similarity to ourselves. So I think maybe it's that desire to connect, really, to people from the past. And in terms of writing fiction, the way I look at it is that whether you're trying to write about the past, or trying to write history, I always try and find the best genre or the best vehicle for telling a particular story. So for instance, the two novels that I've written are about the women in Oliver Cromwell's family. And I only wrote them as novels, really, because I started trying to write about them as a non-fiction narrative history book. And I just thought it'd be really dull because I would keep having to say in my book things like, well, we think Mrs. Cromwell was missing her husband when he was away on campaign, or we believe that their daughter Elizabeth felt so and so. Because as so often with women in the past, they're just so much in the margins of the accounts that we have. They're in the sort of the footnotes, the margins, they're walk-on characters, whereas we know, obviously, they had enormously important lives. So I actually decided that historical fiction might be a way in if I could put everything that we knew about them from a historical point of view into the story, but then piece those bits together and plug any gaps with my own imagination. It might be a way to get them out there.
You see, this does intrigue me enormously because obviously right at the moment, at the time of recording, the final series of Wolf Hall is out about an entirely different Cromwell. And what Hilary Mantel did was, I guess, latch on to a much written about character, Thomas Cromwell. I mean, I remember as a youth, it was all Tudors. We studied that at A level, and we studied, I think, Geoffrey Elton. Didn't he have two completely different versions of Tudor history, one in which, you know, Henry VIII was the architect of it, and the other one in which Thomas Cromwell is the architect of it. So you've got this wonderful collection of books now being dramatized, but they're based around somebody around whom there's so much detail, whereas your main protagonists are people around whom there's virtually no detail. So are you using them to broaden our understanding of Oliver Cromwell? Or really, is it, as you sort of said there, that women in history are so often overlooked that we have to do an awful lot of the piecing together? I suppose we have to fill in that vacuum, don't we?
Well, exactly. I guess I'm trying to do a bit of both. And I'm pleased you mentioned the Wolf Hall series and Thomas Cromwell, because actually the new book I'm writing, which I can tell you more about, but which is actually a non-fiction, a history book about the whole Cromwell family, which is tying Oliver back to Thomas and Henry VIII and the Reformation. And as you say, it's so interesting with some of the members of the family, you know, we know an awful lot. And with some, you know, we know hardly anything. So trying to write about them and keep a sort of balance in how you look at them is very challenging. Oliver Cromwell, for instance, had more biographies written about him than virtually any other character in history. There's a huge glut of them out at the moment. And most biographers of Oliver Cromwell, one of the main things that they have to decide for themselves at the outset is how they're going to approach Cromwell's own voice, Oliver Cromwell's own writings, because we have so many of his letters and speeches and things he's meant to have said. We have a new 3-volume edition, which has been published by Oxford University Press under the general editorship of Professor John Morrill from Cambridge, which has taken about 15 years to put together. I've got it behind me. It's three big volumes. But again, you know, you have to decide, am I taking this man at his own word? Is everything he's saying true? Do I believe that? Do I try and interrogate it? And historians have come to different conclusions. Professor John Morrill takes him more at his word, just to make it very generalized. Professor Ronald Hutton, who's got another big book out at the moment about Oliver Cromwell, is more skeptical, has a more skeptical take. So actually, you can be challenged either by having too little information or too much sometimes.
I'm not surprised there's all this volume, because I was listening to one of your podcasts the other day, and you sort of blithely mentioned that Oliver Cromwell, was it in the Putney debates, spoke for 3 hours?
Yeah.
Oh, did he? He spoke for 3 hours. I mean, and all of that presumably is transcribed and available, which is, I mean, so different from, you know, my area of expertise, if you want to call it, when I first started studying, would have been the ancients. So you'd get the voice of Caesar. But everybody knew that Julius Caesar was just making this up. It's mostly nonsense, self-aggrandizing drivel. But for the most part, we don't really have the same quantity, I guess, of archive. Whereas you, in sifting through all that, it just strikes me, let's get right to the nub of this. The 17th century, you've suddenly got an awful lot more information, haven't you, than you probably had 100 years, and then going backwards, it just diminishes all the time. So is that what drew you to the 17th century initially?
Absolutely. It was a really good point. And I remember this just going back in time to my own history undergraduate. I did a classical history paper, which I loved. I loved classical history as well. And it's so interesting exactly what you say. You know, the historians' craft is so different if they're studying the ancient world, if they're studying the medieval world, the early modern world, the modern world, in terms of, you know, what they're trying to piece together. I remember I actually really quite liked the freedom that you have in the classical world to put together a really grand theory, you know, and just pull different strands into it. There's a lot of space, I feel, for the voice of the historian when you're dealing with the classical world, even the Anglo-Saxon world, you know, too, the medieval world. You know, there's a lot of, when you think about arguments about the Vikings, for instance, you know, to what extent are they raping and pillaging? To what extent are they very nice farmers just looking for, you know, extra land? You know, all those debates, that there's a lot of room for the historian to weigh in there and say, I think this, I think that, here's my list of evidence. And as you say, the 17th century feels like this massive turning point. I make this point often, really, in that, you know, for so many ways, firstly, as you say, it is this explosion of print culture in particular, with the ending of censorship at the time of the Civil Wars. And, you know, we've had over a century of the printing press at this point. It's absolute explosion in printing and pamphleteering. Everyone can have their say. We have the first weekly newspapers, for instance, come in the 1640s. And as you say, we also have all the speeches. We have people keeping diaries. That's a real 17th century fashion. And we have all this voluminous correspondence. So it is definitely the period of the word. You don't study it if you don't love language. and oratory and references and arguments about language and the power of language. And I think where I really fell in love with the period, with the civil wars in particular, was when I realized that they were the first wars that were fought not about who should rule, but about how they should rule. And that is such a modern concept. So before that, you know, just to get a bit of Tudor Wars of the Roses bashing in here, and I do love the Tudors and the Wars of the Roses. But, you know, if you go back to the Wars of the Roses, great fun as it is, you know, the Yorkists, the Lancastrians, it's all about who should rule. It's all about lineage and connections and who's related to who. And that's what the whole conflict is about. Whereas you fast forward to the 1640s, and it's about ideas. It's about sovereignty. It's about democracy, representative democracy, in a sense, in Parliament. It's about where is the balancing line? Where's the line between the state's obligation to secure everyone's safety versus individual freedom? This is what Thomas Hobbes is banging on about, and John Locke. So it really feels like this extraordinary turning point in world history, British history, but also world history, where we're moving into the modern era and so many of the institutions, the ideas, the dividing lines, the fault lines that we're now still living with are set up, are originated in the 17th century. They had an awful lot to say.
Right. But I want to come to something now, and this might just be my own perspective, but it strikes me that in Britain especially, there's a remarkable ignorance about the 17th century and especially about the Civil War, whereas there isn't a remarkable ignorance about how many wives Henry VIII had, which is terribly depressing after hearing what you just said there, that you've got one era which is about how we're going to be governed, which is surely the thing that should be most interesting, as opposed to who's governing and which wife he's currently got. If I look at my watch, oh, it's that Catherine. You know, it's not boring, but it's also kind of trivial in a way, whereas you're talking about these massive concepts. Am I wrong in perceiving that Britain doesn't really have a particularly good relationship with its civil war, hasn't really sort of come to terms with what it was about and who was involved and why?
You're not wrong at all, Daniel. And actually, that's one of the key inspirations for me to work on this period, is exactly that. I feel it's woefully neglected, given its huge importance to us. I think I have lots of pet theories about this, and historians like me of this period constantly go on about it. You know, we're the underdog and we want people to care more about it. Tudors get all the airtime. But I think as a nation, we have, as you say, a bit of a psychological problem with the civil wars. We don't really know what to do with it because it doesn't fit into our neat national story of kings and queens stretching back 1,000 years. And if, you know, you look at the school, the ruler, the wooden ruler that we all have at school with all the kings and queens on, William, Henry, Stephen, Henry, Richard, John, you know, that's what we all cling to. And I love that too. I'm a monarchist. It's wonderful that we have this monarchy that goes back so far. But if you look at that ruler, or any timeline really, in any historic palace or textbook or information board, has this little awkward little gap in the 1640s and 50s, sometimes called the interregnum, sometimes called the Commonwealth, sometimes it just says civil wars, sometimes it says Oliver Cromwell, sometimes even Richard Cromwell, which is a bonus. And actually, we're all living from the hymn sheet penned by Charles II at the Restoration, where in 1660, where he backdated his reign to the moment his father had been executed 11 years earlier, and actually brought in legislation, the Act of Oblivion, and Indemnity and Oblivion, to legislate that period out of existence and say, no one is to talk about it. It didn't happen. None of the laws that were passed there exist anymore. So he consigned it into the dustbin of national memory. That's the way I see it. And I think now we really struggle with what to do with it. Do we celebrate it? Is it important? Is it not important? I think a lot of people assume that because Parliament won the Civil War, but then the King came back anyway, it sort of equaled itself out. So we don't really need to bother understanding it. Whereas actually, you know, it's as fundamental to where we end up here in 2024, as I'd argue the American Revolution is to America, the French Revolution is to France. And indeed, actually, in those other countries, America and France in particular, they're far more interested and inspired by our civil wars than we are ourselves. I have some silly theories too. I think that Puritans are a bit unsexy. I think people think they're dour, boring. You know, I think the religious side of it's tricky to explain to people. Although, you know, I'm always amazed by how people will get into the Reformation thanks to the Tudors. You know, they really will get into the weeds and the knotty weeds of diaspora and a bishop's vestments and transubstantiation. And there's a lot of big stuff happening there too in terms of ideas, particularly on that topic, which we don't shy away from. So, you know, I think we should stop patronising the public. I think they can take this stuff. It's big and it's meaty. It's incredibly complicated, but it's incredibly important, and we should stop trying to skip over it because we're embarrassed, and actually acknowledge, in my view, that this period and Oliver Cromwell in particular actually contributed more than probably anyone else, possibly anyone else in the whole of our monarchical past, to the fact that we still have a constitutional monarchy today. So, you know, the monarchy today shouldn't be scared of him. They should be talking about it.
So do you think that's where it sort of comes from, in that because we still do have a monarchy, and I'm going to ask you at the same time if there are any other countries that have experienced a revolution and an aftermath quite like ours. Is it sort of because we've got King Charles III that to recall the civil wars would be a bit distasteful? Because you just have to point out that, well, your relative 400 years ago had his head lopped off, and no one really wants to talk about it. Is that what it is? Are we just sort of a little embarrassed?
I think it's a large part of it, absolutely. And I think, as I say, from 1660 onwards, there's a long period where one is not meant to talk about the civil wars. Oliver Cromwell becomes this great kind of bogeyman, this villain of our national past. But then on the other hand, there have been periods in the past, notably in the 19th century, where actually the civil wars were very fashionable and people in power were talking about them and were talking very positively about Oliver Cromwell and about parliamentarians. Cromwell and the parliamentarians were huge heroes to the Victorians. This is when Cromwell's statue goes up outside Parliament, for instance, the Thornycroft statue. So there have been times in the past where clearly as a nation we have felt more positively towards this period and felt that we can take something away from it. Cromwell and all the Levellers in particular were also huge heroes, you know, for the Chartists and for other movements in the 19th century, movements towards, you know, parliamentary reform. And this is another brilliant thing about this period and about Cromwell in particular, is that he can be hero or villain to left and right because he's such a complex figure. And at the time, in his own lifetime, he was praised and vilified for very much competing things. So he can at once be the hero of parliamentary sovereignty, you know, the conscientious man with the Bible in his hand, you know, thundering away outside Parliament, and a hero to the left, a hero to the Chartists, and also the man who helps to bring in that sort of plethora of churches and, you know, Methodism and non-conformist religion. But on the other hand, he can be seen as this destroyer of Parliament and this authoritarian figure, a military dictator to some people. It's terribly complicated. The fact that we still have the monarchy, and we still have a great deal of deference for our monarchy, you know, quite rightly, it is a bit of a problem. And you see this actually in the actions sometimes of various monarchs in the past. Elizabeth II, for instance, once vetoed a whole set of commemorative stamps, which Tony Benn had tried to bring in, this is a long time ago, of different heads of state. She didn't want there to be one of Oliver Cromwell, so the whole lot were scrapped. Similarly, at Sidney Sussex College in Cambridge, Cromwell's old college, there are curtains around his portrait so that if a visiting royal comes to the college, the curtains can be drawn and the royal won't have to gaze on his warts and all face. And that is another example during the war, well, earlier in the 20th century, Winston Churchill, when he was in the Admiralty, wanted to name a battleship, I think it was, the Cromwell, and the king said no. So, you know, we may have forgotten about this period in the public eye, but those in power and in Buckingham Palace certainly haven't forgotten about it.
You see, he reminds me a little bit, and please forgive my ignorance here, but I'm sort of looking for historical parallels. General Sulla in the first century BC sort of set himself up as a dictator, but very briefly. And the speculation is largely that what he wanted to do was restore the previous order, restore the republic, restore the way they went about it. And he gets kind of airbrushed out of Roman history a little bit because of his sort of dictatorial behaviour for a couple of years, and then he goes and disappears onto his farm and dies after eating a million lampreys or whatever it is. He gets kind of portrayed in history a little bit like Oliver Cromwell does, which is sort of bilious, kind of unpleasant character. Whereas in listening to your podcast, one of the themes that comes through is just how much Oliver Cromwell seemed to be quite keen on having a monarchy, restoring it in some way or other. I mean, I think there's one great episode that you have in which you explain to us that he spends ages just before the death of Charles defending monarchy as an institution, which I don't think people remotely understand about Cromwell. I mean, what is that? What's going on here, Miranda?
Oh, that's so interesting. I've got so many things to say to that, Dan. There's so many great points there. Firstly, on the ancient parallels, absolutely they're there. And you might be interested to hear that when he was living at Hampton Court, when he was Lord Protector, so he was effectively head of state, king in all but name, Cromwell in the 1650s, and he lives for the weekend country retreaters at Hampton Court. He has there the wonderful paintings by Mantegna of the Triumph of Caesar. And they're all along the gallery. And Cromwell saves them from sale, from the public sale after the king's execution, because I think he loved them and thought they were wonderful. And obviously, there's a real parallel there with Caesar and with Cromwell. I was thinking too of Augustus when you were talking about autocratic figures who were also simultaneously proclaiming that they're actually there to restore a republic or freedoms. It's quite a well-known path in the past, isn't it, to have people who are sort of straddling that gap, trying to ride those two horses at once. And Cromwell himself actually looked to a lot of these parallels, particularly biblical parallels, but also sometimes ancient ones, for figures who he admired. There was one called Gideon, who was very keen on people who had been called up to serve and had led an army into victory, but then retired back to their farm. You know, that was an idea that he really liked. And he always talked about himself when he was in power as being a farmer, being a good constable, watching over the country. He reached for those sort of earthy, rustic, rural ideas. It wasn't about the glamour, it was about the, you know, the steadfastness. And his greatest fear was being accused of being overly ambitious and hypocritical, which is the main reason why when Parliament eventually tries to make him king and offers him the crown in 1657, he rejects it. And that is despite, as you absolutely say correctly, Daniel, that he was a monarchist. So the complicated thing about Cromwell is that he was anti-formalist. So he didn't really care. The phrase he used was that he wasn't wedded and glued to forms of government. So he wasn't really interested in the details of exactly how constitutions worked. He was very open-minded, and he felt the same about religion. He didn't really care that much how church services were organized or not organized, or, you know, ritual and what's in the prayer book and what's not in the prayer book. He cared about the ends. He cared about closeness to God, and he cared about effective government. And we have, you know, plenty of evidence to show, not least, as you say, his huge efforts after the civil wars to try and negotiate with Charles I and keep him on his throne, to Cromwell's own detriment with his reputation amongst his own rank and file, who felt he was betraying them for doing this. We know that he felt that of all the different forms of government, probably a limited constitutional monarchy was the best. And that's why, I think, because he knew that intellectually, he was very tempted to become king when Parliament asked him to. But again, we have a clash there within him, and he's a man who has a great deal of tumult always happening within him. There's a clash there between the pragmatist who thinks this is the best form of government, I should just become king myself, and the man who feels much more emotional sort of man, much more radical man, much more all about his religious faith, his loyalty to the army. And, you know, he felt God had witnessed against kingship in the form of Charles I and monarchy more generally, and that to disobey him by taking the crown for himself would have been wrong. But yes, he was a monarchist. It's the first thing I say to people when they have a go at me that Cromwell was a republican. I say, well, actually, he was a monarchist.
Is it any wonder, I suppose, that by 1660 you get the restoration of the monarchy if the Civil War was about a monarchist trying to depose a monarch? I mean, no wonder we're all deeply confused about our own revolution. I mean, I can't imagine Robespierre, for example, being a monarchist. It doesn't make any sense.
We're all hugely confused, Daniel. And then also, but that's also why I think it's so fascinating. And that's because, as so often with civil wars, particularly, you know, big revolutions like this in thought, it's far easier to get a coalition together to defeat a common enemy than it is to then pull something down is very easy. To then decide and agree on what to create in its place is very, very difficult. And actually, what's particularly fascinating to me in the 1640s and 50s is the coalition on the Parliament side that comes together to defeat the king, but then how they splinter apart afterwards because they all want different things. And that ranges from, you know, really quite conservative monarchists who want to keep a monarchy that was very similar to the one that we'd had before it was felt that Charles I had overstepped his prerogative powers in 1614, 41, 42 and went to war. You have those people right down to the levellers, or even beyond the levellers. You have people who want everything in society, you know, shared, the diggers, the ranters, you know, so all of those people are on the same side, which is never going to be very sustainable. And actually, it's one of the things that Cromwell is best at, in a sense, is presiding over shifting coalitions and interest groups. And again, something people don't know about him is that he was someone who very much brought other groups together. He was a deal maker, not to make him sound too Trumpian, but he was a deal maker who kept coalitions on side. And there was a sense during the 1650s that there's an argument that it was him that was keeping the ship of state afloat, and that, you know, once he died, it was all going to fall to pieces. That isn't necessarily true, but there's something in that.
Now, you've mentioned the levellers a few times, and they're kind of heroes of mine from when I was younger. I didn't really know much about them, but they were sort of like the first, in my brain, they were like the first lefties in Britain. And this struck me as being extremely romantic. Is this really massively unusual, this sort of train of thought, the early 17th century? Because, I mean, I don't really see it in the ancient history that I studied, I suppose, to a degree, the Athenian democracy, but really, I mean, I'd have to stretch the point to make it kind of work, to make it equivalent with the Athenian democracy. You know, Britain feels pretty much as you articulated before, a series of passings of one king to another, different families, disputes over who should be in charge. The reason I'm trying to frame this question, it's a very long question, but there was something else that came up in one of your podcasts that really struck me about, was it the levellers who, or some levellers at any rate, who wanted to be rid of the Norman yoke, which I found fascinating, that actually their argument is that from 1066, the whole thing went to pot. And therefore, did they have a kind of misty-eyed idea that there was some sort of communitarian anarcho-syndicalist commune existing within England before William the Conqueror turned up?
Yes, there was this idea. It fascinates me too, Dan, that idea of the Norman yoke. I first came across it really at university when I was being lectured about it. But there is this idea, and it doesn't originate with the levellers. It's there in the pamphlet war that accompanies, that leads up to the outbreak of the Civil War in 1642. It's there earlier in the 1630s as well in the voices, these sort of slightly anti-royalist voices that are publishing around that time. There is this idea that really since 1066, everything's been a stitch-up. These ancient English peoples, who Anglo-Saxons who were living before then, you know, have been under the boot ever since of a royal family that was first the Normans, and then, of course, you know, the Plantagenets, we have the medieval period, and that the Tudors, and then the Stuarts are seen as the heir to this suppression, this autocracy that is squatting on top of your normal yeomanry, your normal English yeomanry.
600 years later.
Indeed, absolutely. Well, nothing can kill a good story like this, can it? I mean, it's very emotive. And there is this sense particularly that the Stuarts are a real aberration here because they've come down from Scotland. So they're not even very English, you know, they're Scottish, which is obviously all appalling. And there is this attempt in the 1640s and 50s. And I even notice it actually in how Oliver Cromwell's rule as Lord Protector is presented and how people write about him, funnily enough. There is this attempt to use the civil wars to go back in time and to leap back before 1066. Actually, it's a bit analogous in a sense to in the Reformation arguments under Henry VIII that were being made, that, you know, the Church of Rome was the aberration and that, you know, England needed to get back to before all the nonsense that had come from Rome and get back to what had actually happened and to the Bible, and, you know, reclaim its own sovereignty. So throughout the past, I think there is this, in all sorts of different countries and cultures, I guess, there is this sense that to appeal to people, to almost, you dress up change as conservatism, you dress up change as a reaching back. I mean, think about Make America Great Again today. Think about Take Back Control in Brexit. It's a very powerful argument to say, don't be scared by the changes that we are trying to advocate for. Actually, it's going back in time to before some recent aberration. It's going back to reclaim things that should rightly be ours.
It's a bit like the Great Replacement Theory, isn't it? Except they were scared that they were being replaced by Normans, mountebanks, Scots, the French, whoever else it happened to be. One other strand that comes through listening to you talk about history is very blithely people can say things are inevitable or this is the way history works, if you like. And I was listening to one of your episodes and it was talking about Shogun and it was inspired by the story of Shogun, which is currently on TV. And I think one of your contributors said that Japan and Britain were like mirror images of each other. They had similar climates. They were island nations on completely other sides of the world. And yet the course of British history at that time was very outward reaching, very exploratory. And at the end of the sort of Shogun period that we're talking about 1620, Japan goes right back into itself after a very brief period of being outward looking. And you make it the point that things don't just happen inevitably because you are an island nation with a temperate climate, with a very highly developed culture. It doesn't automatically mean you can do one thing or the other. And this is a theme that comes up quite a lot in your podcast and what you talk about, that history is not inevitable. It's like a snapshot. Is that a fair summation?
I think very much so. At least that's the way I see it. Maybe it's because I particularly like human agency and I like mistakes and coincidences. And, you know, I've got plenty of space in my mind for the way I see the past for all of that. You know, that whole idea that, you know, history is one, you know, one effing thing after another or whatever. I do think actually one of the fascinations for me is that very lack of inevitability. It is the forks in the road and, you know, to bang on the drum again, but it's another reason why I love the period that I write about mostly, the 1640s and 50s, is because really anything could have happened. It could have gone in any different direction at that point. And there's a, you know, very viable counterfactual in which, you know, Oliver Cromwell had lived a bit longer, perhaps, and maybe he had taken the crown, whatever. And, you know, maybe the monarchy hadn't come back. Cromwell now would have the status probably in our country of a George Washington kind of figure, you know, a founder of an entirely different constitution regime. But there are so many forks in the road. And I think that it's helpful to realize that. It also gives you as a historian, I mean, looping back to our theme of inspiration, I find it very helpful to my own life to have that sense of perspective and to have that sense when I look about, you know, the world today or politics, you know, there's no kind of arc, natural arc towards progress. And what does progress mean anyway? It means different things to different people. And, you know, things can go notionally backwards, notionally forwards. All of this is just the way that we talk about things in order to make sense of them for ourselves, you know, aren't we? We were just talking about arguments which can be maybe thought progressive, but they're dressed up as being reactionary in order to make them less, more appealing. It's all so much more slippery than we think. And similarly, in the civil wars, you know, there's no straight line through king versus parliament, you know, roundheads and cavaliers. That doesn't track neatly up to the present day. It's very hard, you know, you can't kind of go backwards and say when people try and bring it into modern life and talk about it during Brexit or for particular public figures, you know, might say Boris Johnson or Theresa May, or he's very cavalier, he's very parliamentarian, whatever around it. It is very, very hard to kind of keep that tracked because actually it just wiggles all over the place and people swap sides and people swap, you know, and whole parties swap different coalitions that they're representing. So, yes, I think it is important to remember that nothing is inevitable, and that if you see the past too much, believing it to be ordained, in my period, that's called the high road to restoration. There's this idea that restoration of the monarchy was always going to happen. That was just inevitable. And that was actually peddled again, really, since the restoration, because that's a sort of a good line to take. But actually, what historians need to do, and what people of, you know, members of the public who love history and want to engage with it, you know, have fun, pick those narratives apart. Don't take at face value any big convenient theory that's being presented to you. You know, have it, sit down and think, oh, hang on a minute. Just pick a few of those pieces out and see if the whole thing falls apart and let's start again. And that's what everyone who writes books about the past is doing all the time.
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem to help not seeing the inevitability of this, that Richard Cromwell was his successor. You therefore think, oh, well, hang on a minute. Not a great deal has changed, actually. No wonder they're going to restore a monarch, because if you're going to have a successor to this guy, you may as well just have had the successor to the previous guy. Is that also fair?
Yes, on the one hand, yes. And on the one hand, no. Richard Cromwell was a bit more competent than his name of Tumbledown Dick, which has stuck with him down the ages, would suggest. He was that he had actually had a reasonable amount of preparation for this possible role. Although we don't know, again, you know, it's one of the unknowns. We don't know for certain that Oliver Cromwell did nominate him to be his successor. He never wrote it down. It was what he was supposed to have said on his deathbed to John Thurlow, the secretary of the council. And certainly the council rally around Richard and proclaim him immediately as the successor. But we don't actually know he intended to do that. And again, like so many sovereigns, it was one of his big failings, Cromwell, was that he didn't really adequately prepare for a succession. But again, he hadn't had long to get used to the idea that it was within his power to nominate a successor. Up until 1657, it was not going to be up to him. It was going to be up to Parliament and the council. But part of the new powers he gets when Parliament tries to make him king, and he says, no, I won't be king, but he says, I will accept the rest of this new constitution. Again, incidentally, Britain's second and last written constitution, the Humble Petition and Advice in 1657, he gets the power to nominate his heir. And it's a bit confusing, really, because you think, well, on the one hand, this is a republic, and we've got away with monarchy. So, you know, surely we should have a sort of meritocratic system where you nominate the best people get elected or chosen. On the other hand, we've just given this guy the power to nominate his own successor. And actually, it takes a really conservative turn because, as you say, his eldest surviving son, you know, two older sons who died, succeeded him. So there are lots of arguments among geeks and historians of this period. You know, what would have happened if a much more capable figure had been nominated or chosen, another major general like John Lambert? And it might have been entirely different. So as you say, it is, again, you've got to take that narrative and then sort of pull it back apart a little bit and work it out and think about, you know, the paths not taken. I've read something recently, some wonderful quote about when you're writing about people and writing about the past and trying to get into the mindset of people, the best historical writing is almost writing about people who are planning for a future that never comes to pass. So you're almost doing a real trick when you're trying to get into the minds, as Hilary Mantel did so brilliantly with Thomas Cromwell. You're trying to get into the mind of someone. You're trying to pretend you don't know what happens to them. And you're trying to imagine all the things they think that could happen to them and therefore what they're planning for.
Well, I'm glad you raised that because we are running out of time and I haven't unfortunately got onto my favourite war, the 30 Years' War, or the Dutch Revolt, or any of the things that I wanted educating on.
Oh, great subjects.
I know.
Great subjects. But have me back to talk about those.
Well, we can get all those on 1666 and all that. But before I let you go, my last question is something that you've teed up for me very nicely, actually. The people involved and you as an historian, because you talk with such passion and excitement and you've written novels. Do you end up having like a kind of hit list of your favourites? Sounds like an incredibly banal question, but you're so immersed in someone like Oliver Cromwell. Do you find yourself getting a bit too close or just close enough? Or do you have really passionate kind of feelings about these people from the past?
It's not a banal question. It's a really good question. And actually one that's particularly pertinent to writers like me who are writing about real historical people. I do feel a sense of responsibility to the people that I'm writing about, not least because I also write about them as an academic, as a historian as well. So just to confuse myself even further. So yes, I do feel a responsibility to them and an affection for them, a familiarity with them. Again, I would class myself as one of those historians who probably feels a bit too much and empathizes a bit too much. That's the novelist in me. I have to remind myself not to be partisan and not to, you know, and to challenge myself about where my sympathies lie, as we all have to do when one is, you know, writing, trying to write in a balanced way and trying to be fair to historical subjects. And this is a period in which, you know, we're very quick to give partisan views because it's part of the fun. You know, this was a civil war. So everyone who writes about this period makes jokes. Oh, I'd have been a parliamentarian. I'd have been a royalist. I'd have cut his head off. You know, I wouldn't have done. You know, it's kind of the jokes that we all like to make. I guess you have to, on the one hand, you have to try and suspend some of that in order to do your job as a historian and try and be as objective as you can within the limits of that. But on the other hand, when you do write as a novelist, and also when you write as a historian, hopefully with the passion, with proper passion, and you can't take yourself out of the picture entirely, and you're always going to have affection and that's probably going to creep into your writing. But, you know, I can live with that. I actually think it's better to have exciting, passionate, well-written books which communicate a love for a subject and maybe which carry an audience along with them, than the most perfectly scientific and dry and on the fence and objective, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, essay answer writing. I think, you know, let's get a bit of the historian back in there, as we were saying earlier about writing about the ancients or the medieval period. Let's bring some of that chutzpah into this period and later periods, I think.
I'm going to put you on the spot then. My very last, very, very last question, I promise you. If technologically we could recreate any character from the 17th century and plonk them down in front of you, you've got an hour that you can spend with them. Firstly, who do you really want to pick the brains of? Who do you want to find out from in that hour? And it could be the same person. This is a ridiculous question, but who's your favourite?
Oh, gosh. Oh, so many people. What a great question. Oh, so many people. The tedious, obvious answer is Cromwell, just because no one understands him still. No one fully understands him. We all spend our whole careers trying to understand him. And also because he was famous for being great company. He had a real talent for friendship. He was very, very sociable. He liked debate and disputes over a glass of wine, so he'd have been good company. He liked to hear different viewpoints. And also he liked, you know, drinking, smoking, having a good time, partying generally. He's a big prankster. Yeah, people don't realise that about him.
I genuinely never realised that. He's painted as a complete opposite of that.
He's painted as a dour killjoy. Well, we're back to our Restoration myth-making here. And, you know, part of that, there's a grain of truth in there. Of course, there always is with myth-making. You know, he was a Puritan and you know, he didn't approve of certain things. But a lot of what's laid at his door, cancelling Christmas, you know, shutting the theatres, all this kind of stuff, was done by Parliament years before he was in power. So Christmas is cancelled in the mid-1640s as a sop to the Scots, who Parliament wants, you know, to bring into the war on their side, actually the Presbyterian Scots. And Cromwell's great crime against Christmas is that he doesn't reverse that legislation when he's in power. But he never says anything about Christmas. I mean, I just don't think he cared either way, particularly. And similarly with lots of other things, you know, horse racing, theatres. He loved horse racing. He loved gambling, playing cards, drinking, smoking, all that kind of thing. Riding, hawking. He was a real kind of gentleman. He loved all those pursuits. But again, closing the theatres, closing the race courses, that was all about preventing royalist groups getting together, because that's where they often like to do it. You know, so yes, he would have been quite fun. Samuel Pepys would have been enormous fun. I've got a huge soft spot for him. And I think his diary, coming back to why the 17th century is so wonderful, I think these diaries, particularly Pepys's diary, is just, it's like a portal, takes you straight into the mind of someone from, you know, several hundred years ago, because he's such a real flesh and blood person, you know, with his own vanities and his own flaws and his own feelings. So he would be absolutely wonderful. John Lambert would have been another a dinner party choice for me. I'd like to write a book about him actually in the future, because he's probably one of the most important and famous Britons that no one today has heard of, because he was a leading commander in the New Model Army and was just as talented as Oliver Cromwell and just as important in winning the second and third Civil Wars. And then he's the power behind the throne really during the Protectorate, and it's him who writes Britain's first constitution, the instrument of government, which brings Cromwell in as Lord Protector. So he's a big power behind the throne in the 1650s. He lives in the old royal mansion at Wimbledon, which used to be Henrietta Maria's house. And I love that idea. He was a great gardener. He brought in various varieties of tulips and did lots of landscape gardening design. And then he gets arrested, as so many did, at the Restoration. And he's cast into various awful prisons on various islands. He's in Guernsey at various points. And he spends the last few decades of his life a prisoner, and some of it in solitary confinement, and dies on an island called Devil's Island. It's all very dramatic. So there's all these wonderful characters from this period. It's another reason that it's so worthwhile for people to study. So, you know, I'd be spoiled for choice. But I'd like some of the women too, just because I'd like to know what it was really like to be a woman in the 17th century and to really get inside that.
So we've got a dinner party. I'm up for that. Don't know why I restricted it just to one person. Let's have a dinner party. I think that's where we should leave it. I've been inspired. I'm inspired by Oliver Cromwell now. I'm going to go and find out an awful lot more about him. I urge all of you out there to pick up Miranda Maidens' book and listen to her podcast, 1666, and all that. Miranda, thank you so much for being on Inspired Minds.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Miranda Maidens. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The opinions expressed by guests on Rathbones Inspired Minds are personal and will not necessarily reflect the views of Rathbones Investment Management, nor will they constitute a recommendation or advice to buy or sell any product or service on behalf of Rathbones Group PLC.